Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once more, we are incredibly lucky as we step into the centre circle with arguably one of the best football writers that this country has produced. Before we get to who that is, people might have their own opinions and might be disappointed when I announce who it is, but I don't think you will be. But before I announce who it is, I can guarantee you it's not Stephen Scragg, because he's one of the co-hosts. Stephen, welcome.
Welcome. I'll take that as I'm happy with that.
You were close. Yeah.
I was close. to be within the association of the kind of like the sentences of the opening. I'm taking that and I'm running with it.
Looking forward to this one.
Yes, massively. You know, wonderful author, wonderful book, and it'll be a great hour or so.
It absolutely will. It absolutely will. And second co-host is a man for all occasions and a man for a story or two for every occasion, Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, you okay?
I'm fine, Stuart. Thank you for that brilliant introduction as well. I really appreciate that. And yeah, really looking forward to speaking to our guest tonight. The book's fabulous. Some of his other books have been well worth reading as well. So, you know, we've got a master of football writing craft here this evening. And I'm really looking forward to listening to his views and opinions about the modern game today.
And I hope we haven't frightened him off, to be fair, with this build-up. Tonight's guest is the wonderful Michael Calvin, award-winning sports writer, obviously best-selling author. Paul's alluded to some of the books that are already out there. State of Play, No Hunger in Paradise, to name just but a couple. Sports Book of the Year prize in successive years, where the Nowhere Men picked up one of those awards. Former Sports Writer of the Year, twice been named Sports Reporter of the Year, and has featured in the British Sports Book Awards on six other occasions. Is the most prestigious football writer we've probably had in the centre circle so far. And we're here to talk about the new book, Whose Game Is It Anyway? Football, Life, Love and Loss. Michael, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, boys. You've made an old hack blush. Thank you.
No problem. No problem at all. So we'll get straight in. We'll get straight in with the book. Obviously, you were with us a couple of years ago, chatting about the State of Play. Wonderful, wonderful book. And then we come to this one, which sort of written during the lockdown period. And I guess that's whilst the book spans practically your entire lifetime, a lot of it has been sort of come to the fore because of the situation we've all been in the last 12 months. But before we sort of discuss the intricacies of the 25 chapters, just a little bit about sort of what the book is about, but also why now. You know, was it the pandemic? Was it the situation we found ourselves in?
Well, I suppose the best way to describe it in a nice sort of neat alliterative way is that it's sort of part memoir, part manifesto for football or for sport in general in many ways as well. You know, you were right, Stu. Really, I think the book does reflect the time in which it was written, the pandemic. And I suppose the trigger factor, which obviously sets the book up in the opening chapter, was the death of my father-in-law in his care home in Devon last May. And it was that time, wasn't it, the lockdown, I think a lot of us were sort of plunged into our own sort of quiet search for meaning in things. And I found, beyond the pain of bereavement, something quite special about the nature of the final conversations I had with my father-in-law. You know, I'd known him for 45 years, you know, wonderful grandpa to my kids. I knew of his background. He was in the war as a Royal Marine Commando, but that generation did hide things away, didn't they? They locked up their emotions. And this was also at a time where, you know, I'd increasingly fallen out of love with the modern game. The, you know, insanely commercialized, innately cynical world of modern football, of Swiss models, of super leagues, of vulture capitalists getting involved in clubs for their own very, very narrow money-making ends. And, you know, that type of cynicism wore me down. I probably reflected that cynicism in a way because I still, I suppose, to all intents and purposes, was you know, putting myself out there as a devotee of the game, which, you know, I still was. I still loved the game. I didn't love the industry, I suppose. But it was the death of my father-in-law, I said, from COVID, it exposed that grotesque lie that the government had put a you know, put their tender arms around the care home system. He was infected with COVID along with five other residents from another resident who'd been into hospital after a fall, came out without a test and infected essentially his entire floor. He was suffering from dementia, or accelerated form of vascular dementia, to be precise. And so the curtains were being closed across many areas of his life very quickly anyway. And in the last sort of week or so of his life, my wife asked him, because we communicated through FaceTime, which was a pretty awful process, but he had a moment of clarity in one call where he recalled being taken as a boy, a 10-year-old boy, to watch his local club, Watford, by his dad, who always used to go and watch him play youth football. You know, my father-in-law, Ollie, was a good footballer, played semi-professional after the war. And there was real clarity in his memory of walking through the terrace streets to the ground, the fact that Saturday represented a treat in the local sweet shop, the anticipation of the game, talking to his dad about it on the way home, you know, in time for tea. And it was that intimacy of that memory was compounded when, you know, when we were looking after his effects, we found in a garden shed a wooden toolbox, and it was full of tools from his father. He was a craftsman. But what struck me was that on the inside of the lid there were three fixture lists from the 1932-33 season, featuring Watford teams, first team, reserve team, and a sort of midweek intermediate team. But above that, there was a very, very small thumbnail photograph of a player. Now, I wondered, you know, who is that, and why did his dad put that on there? He'd actually physically filled in each result in pencil. But it can't, you know, I know my father-in-law was a good player, but it can't have been him, surely, because he was only 11 years old at the time. So it couldn't have been him. I then looked at the club itself, went through the sort of antecedents of that particular time, and tried to find out who the guy in the photograph was. Failed, ultimately, but got to know that football club at that time and the culture of football. But there might have been, there still is, this sort of tantalising possibility that my father-in-law had a trial with Watford, and I wondered whether it was him. Now, I'll never know that, because he passed away before he could tell me one way or the other. And also, in a way, it's probably quite nice that I don't know, because it's that stands to me as almost a symbol of the intimacy of family and football. And that's then got me, that started me on the sort of journey of almost like rediscovery. I had to look at my own life and the lessons of, you know, I've been blessed. You know, I've watched football and major sport in 80 odd countries. And, you know, I'm just a council house kid from Watford. And that's been, it's been quite a cathartic process for me, because it's made me look back at my own experiences and try and work out, well, why did I fall in love with football? And I suppose by going back into my own background, you know, as a kid who, you know, I got TB when I was 16 and was isolated for 3.5 months, almost created my own fantasy football world there. I was determined to get into sports writing, jacked in my A-levels to the disgust of my grammar school headmaster. And then, you know, I had a sort of pretty much a magic carpet ride into Fleet Street as a kid. So I'm looking at all those experiences and trying to work out why this kid fell in love with it all. And I suppose it's in essence, you know, you guys have your own clubs. You got your, you know, in better times, we're able to go to the stadiums. Stadiums have souls. That, you know, a football club isn't about bricks and mortar. It's about people. It's about hearts and minds and flesh and blood. And that was the main lesson I drew from going back into where I'd been, you know, and I suppose if you look across the scope of the book, what I'm trying to do is give the reader an idea of certainly the scope of the stuff that I was lucky enough to do, you know, sailing around the world. You know, I found after 25 years my journal that I was doing, you know, in the deep, you know, deep Southern Ocean. And I've reproduced a couple of entries where a competitor on another boat committed suicide on the way home. He couldn't bear to come to terms with going back to normal life. And in a strange way, I identified that with that, because I went back as chief sports writer of the Daily Telegraph. My role was to do all the big events. Now, I missed the entire inaugural season of the Premier League to do that, which would never be, you know, that would be unheard of in today's journalism because the game's changed so much. But when I got back, I couldn't take football seriously. I couldn't take sport seriously. And it took a conversation with Bobby Charlton, who was a childhood hero of mine, about... it was ostensibly to look forward to the second season of Premier League, which you know, United won the double. But Bobby had actually written to me after the yacht race, basically saying that he identified with the scope of the ambition of all these sort of amateurs who sail around the world the wrong way, never been done before. And I used that as a pretext to try and interview him. And he talked about a football team and a football club as a family. And that was a concept, well, I've used it in a book since, with the book I did with Millwall, you know, literally called Family. But it really almost put me back on track again, that, you know, I was able then to look at, you know, football through a different prism, I suppose. And I've been very fortunate, you know, that I've been face to face with some legendary figures, you know, so Muhammad Ali, you know, the scope of when you've been around for quite a while, your life cycle almost matches that of other people with whom that you've written about. So Bobby Charlton's a good example. He was my schoolboy hero. He played in a press team. We played in Switzerland. I was hopeless, right? I was the worst centre half that you can ever imagine. You know, fifth division of the Watford Sunday League was just about my level. And we were 3-0 down at halftime to the Swiss. And we had a press team with Bobby Charlton and two future England managers, Hal Wilkinson and Terry Venables, playing for us. And in the dressing room at halftime, Bobby was going round saying, "We're going to win this. We can win this. Next goal will get us back in it. They'll go. They'll definitely go." And I'm thinking, I'm on drugs. You know, this is Bobby Charlton. And so we go out. And, of course, you know, right, you guys, you know, understand the writing process. If you look at that, you think, okay, right, what's the fantasy football version of this? Well, the fantasy football version is you win this game 5-4, Bobby Charlton scores the winning goal in the last minute from 35 yards. Dear reader, dear listener, that's exactly what happened. It was just bonkers. So I looked at that and I thought, well, okay. And then I followed this, obviously, his career since, and we had a conversation after I got back from the yacht race. And all, I've been also following the growing scandal of dementia in football, you know, mainly through Dawn Astell and her experiences. And when Bobby was diagnosed with dementia, it wasn't an entirely surprise. A friend of mine had confided, who worked at Manchester United, confided that Bobby had some issues. And obviously, you know, one never reveals that sort of information out of respect and common human decency. But I found that had a big effect on me. You know, that he is, you know, the thing about football and sport is that it enables you to have real intimate contact, sometimes with people you never even meet. You know, all of us on this podcast have got heroes, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I mean, it's, I mean, you know, it's, you know, as you've spoken there, it's almost like the audio version of the book and an abridged version of the book. It's, you know, all those things you say, and it, you know, I suppose it's interesting. I'll come to you first, Paul, because, you know, like you say, your experiences of the game, and for me, what sort of last March did when I stopped work, you know, we sort of walked out of the staff room sort of on a Friday afternoon in March and didn't go back in till August, you know, but what it did do, it certainly afforded a lot of people a lot of time to look at things. You know, it might not have been through football, it could be through any lens, but I guess, you know, for us guys here, it was, you know, football was what we used. And in that first lockdown, Paul, the game stopped, you know, unlike the second and third lockdown where the game carried on, the first lockdown, the game stopped, which really sort of forced, I guess, a lot of people to look at their relationship with the game, because it's the first time there was a real pause in the game. And, you know, for you, Paul, did it, you know, looking, you know, did you find yourself reflecting on the game during the last 12 months?
Yeah, I think so, Stu. I mean, when you look back to the first lockdown, I mean, it's still quite scary now to think of the fact that the Premier League was going to carry on with fixtures that weekend. And it was the Merseyside Derby the following Monday. And of course, my son's at Birmingham University. He comes back home for the Everton games. And we were worried sick about him coming back because we were thinking not going to the game ourselves because we were so worried about the stories coming out about the effect of COVID, etc. So, you know, when that game was called off, it was such a relief. Now, on that same Saturday, my local non-league team, Marine, were playing at home. They got their biggest league gate of the season, nearly 700 for that game. I think people realised then that was going to be the last game of football for a while. So I think you indicated there, Michael, about going through your father-in-law's possession and finding stuff in the box. I mean, what I found myself doing was going back to my treasure trove of programmes, going through things. Because the memories programme is generated, I think it's really underestimated. And the images they can evoke in your memory. And suddenly you're almost there as like a 7-year-old back in that game, watching your team play with 50,000 fans, you know, urging the side forward. So I found myself doing a lot of that. Obviously, I found myself doing a lot of reading. I've read your Joey Barton book, which I really enjoyed as well. And so I just found myself kind of reconnecting with the history of the game a bit more as well. But in terms of, you know, there was it did make you reprioritize things a little bit as well. But I think you touched on the point before, Michael, about the family elements of football. And so halfway through the first lockdown, you're kind of missing your family a lot more. You're kind of missing the routine of the game. You kind of felt though there was a gap in your everyday experiences that you needed to re-engage with at some stage. And it switched from reflections about where we were to anticipation about when will the football be starting again. And you know, you have to say that, but from my perspective, you know, and Steve might well agree with this. I mean, to me, this has just been totally a season where I felt the least engaged with football ever, because consuming a diet of non-stop games on the TV 7 days a week, it does nothing to entice you to watch more. I find myself being incredibly more selective about what I watch these days. And, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in terms of how football reshapes itself, even when crowds are let back in. Because, you know, if it's a process where you're going to have like three negative COVID tests on the day of the match itself before you can get into the ground, I can see a lot of people not actually wanting to buy into that as an experience as well. So it's going to be quite an interesting time to see how that kind of all pans out. But, yeah, I mean, I think it gave us all time for reflection. It gave us all time to think about what the game meant to us. And it also gave us the realisation you can't actually survive without the game, which is sure you find out in about 12 months on your around-the-world trip, Michael.
Yeah, very true.
For you, Stephen, you know, you're a massive one for routine, going to Anfield. You know, you have a young family yourself. And again, you know, did you, like Paul, I guess, as well, and, you know, myself, did you find yourself going, not so much not thinking about the future of football, I have to word this, not thinking about the future of football and where it's going to go and what's going to happen, but more about what has been and what was? You know, did you find yourself going that way rather than forward?
Yeah, I didn't think forwards in any way, shape, or form. You know, if for me it was a case of everything's come to a stop, and who knows when that would alter. You know, these were unprecedented times, they continue to be unprecedented times. I lamented the loss of what we had on the basis that, you know, I still have a season ticket sitting next to my dad, who's in his early 80s. You know, going to the game was his social life. You know, it was keeping him young. You know, we'd park a mile from the ground. You know, the walk to the car and back was great exercise for him. This was something to look forward to. You know, it was there on the calendar. We'd lost my mum 2 years previously. So, you know, it was a vital lifeline for him, basically. And that was my prime issue. It wasn't that, you know, my team was on the brink of winning the league title and they were, you know, it was suddenly, you know, stopped. It was a case of this is, you know, again, it comes down to family, and it's, you know, all of those routines. My dad took me to my first game when I was about three, you know, in 77. And, you know, for me, football, you know, it is me and my dad's relationship, because I'm not a chip off the old block. My brother's the chip off the old block. You know, I'm a very different character, you know, and football is our meeting point, because, you know, it just ticks all the boxes for both of us. It's the shared passion. So, you know, that was my massive worry about it. You know, one of the things that played on my mind hugely throughout, and even now, you know, the idea that I might get to go back with him one day is still, you know, something that's out of reach at the minute. And that depresses me.
I mean, not lucky. That's, that depends how you look at it, I guess. I don't have, you know, the sort of the family connections that you three guys have through family, through football, through dads or granddads or parents or sons. You know, nobody's interested in football here at all. But my advantage was I got to write the book that I wrote through lockdown. But I just had all the time in the world to immerse myself in my greatest sort of most enjoyable era for football, and I just fully immersed myself in that, and was actually almost grateful for the respite, like pausing, you know, the saturation of football and the television, you know, working with students who just want to talk to you about Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, who's the best, who's the third best. That seems to be the best discussion at the moment, and it's like so much more to the game than that. And it was almost nice to have a break from that. But I guess that, Michael, you know, like you said, there's been a lot of, it was a time for a lot of introspection. Do you think that during the last 12 months then, that I suppose society, certainly society in this in this country, you know, local communities, larger communities, have almost found, not created a new relationship, but found a newfound appreciation for football and its potential and where it sits in the community?
Yeah, I do. I think it's that's a sort of multi-layered experience in a way. I think what we're seeing is, you know, there is a generation now headed by Marcus Rashford of athlete activists who frankly have a more considered and, you know, more caring approach or voice, if you like, than any politician that you care to mention. I think that's interesting that how in the sort of vacuum that we've had over the last year, where we used to look at activism and we would look towards North America and, you know, the Tommy Smiths, now Colin Kaepernick. We've had LeBron James active in the presidential elections. Now we've got, you know, people like Rashford, Raheem Sterling, you know, the Liverpool players, you know, being proactive in demonstrating their social consciences. But on a broader level, I think something is happening. You know, when you look at, I think, you know, my own experience, I think I was in danger of losing the emotional connection, because the game as I knew it and the game that I loved had been basically hijacked for commercial gain. And so as a kid, I felt the power of football as a source of community pride and occasional collective insanity. You know, you look around the ground and everyone's going nuts for a goal. You know, that really got very deep with me. I think now that football's a habit. Going to football's a habit like anything else. I think some people might lose that habit, or they might change that habit. And what the pivotal moment in the book for me was, you know, I went through my own experiences. Then I wanted to find out, what's it like when your football club is no longer there? So I went up to Bury and the steam train station there, which is, you know, quite a, it was a fairly bizarre, it was a Saturday morning. I was going to go and watch Bury AFC, the Phoenix Club, in the afternoon. And, you know, met this fan, James Bentley, great guy. You know, we had a beer on platform two, which is an open air bar basically. And there was a couple, and this was about 11:30 in the morning. And I thought, fair play. They had sort of flagons of lager, you know, like sort of like half a gallon of lager each. And they were necking that at about 11:30 on Saturday morning. I thought, well, fair play. So it was the conversation I had with James. It was a pivotal one because I'd never heard a supporter express so eloquently and empathetically what his football club meant to him. And he had to lose that football club through no fault of his own. And it's something that when he found it, it was 11:05 at night on that he'd heard that Bury AFC had been kicked out of the Football League. Oh, sorry, Bury FC had been kicked out of the Football League. And the way he expressed that link was so powerful and so compelling that, well, one actually gave me the idea. I did a documentary for BT Sport called Ours, which was looking at, you know, where we're going to be after the pandemic in terms of the influence of fans on clubs. And that gave me the idea for the documentary, that conversation. I went to the Phoenix Club game in the afternoon. And okay, it was only 150 people there, and socially distanced, but there were football images that I could have had on any ground in the world. You know, little Scallies trying to jump over the wall to get in. You know, there's a young girl with the halftime hot dog, which is almost bigger than her. And I got football again because it was friends meeting friends, having a couple of pints, watching a game. I wonder whether, as we get out of this, what the impact of the machinations around the bigger clubs will be. You know, you guys support emotionally driven, community focused clubs, but those clubs are challenged by their ownership now. If you look around, there's vulture capitalism everywhere. You've got the Glazers at Manchester United. You know, you look at Fenway, that they're getting more and more you know, venture capitalism in there. You know, they've just had another £500 million injection. You've got Stan Kroenke at Arsenal, you know, worth $6 billion because he's learned how to exploit modern sport. You've got fans going into modern stadia, which have the feel of superstores. They're deemed to be consumers. I had a conversation with a mate a few weeks ago, and he's a West Ham fan. And he said, look, one of the things I've been thinking about during the pandemic is that the money I spent on watching West Ham, he said, it's mad. You know, if I used to go and watch my my team with my lad at the Olympic Stadium, I know the owners don't like us calling it the Olympic Stadium anymore, which is precisely why I call it the Olympic Stadium. He said, if I go down there now, you know, get trained down, you know, we live sort of Bedfordshire, Buckinghamshire area, get a train down, a couple of pints before the match, get a bit to eat. For me and my lad, that's £250. He said, well, and I'm sitting in a stadium I hate. Now, he's just moved into a new village. And he said, just down the road, there's a local non-league club, you know, not, I suppose it's, you know, step 10 or whatever it would be. £3 a game, a few pints with my mates. We want to swap ends at half time, we'll do that. I suppose it's a bit Paul. You know, like the experience of Marine.
Yeah,
a lot of people saw Marine in the FA Cup this year and thought, "I'd have a bit of that."
Yeah.
You know, because it's real and there's that intimacy that drew me into the game in the first place. So it's affordable, it's intimate, and it's enjoyable.
And it's the community aspect as well, isn't it, Michael? Because like Marine's ground is a 5-minute walk from my house. You know. Yeah. Remember, son was five. My instruction to football for him was to take him to Marine before we then progressed to work, take him to watch Everton. But yeah, there is more of a sort of relationship you can establish with your local non-league team that you can't establish with, you know, a Premier League team. I mean, for example, when you go to Marines grounds, when you're going through the turnstile, the chairman, Paul Leary, is there shaking your hand as you're going through the turnstile to thank you for coming to watch the game today. You know, John, the master vice chairman, Dave McMahon, will come and side up to you. But I think the game's there, lads. I think it's going. So you get that kind of link that you could just never imagine, that kind of access at Premier League level. And maybe, as you can, I think you kind of suggested there, more and more people might start to question kind of the value for money they're getting and the lack of intimacy they're getting with the bigger teams they're supporting compared to the welcome they get in non-league teams.
I mean, it's a great point. I mean, I live probably 2 or 3 miles from North Ferriby United, who, you know, were a club that, you know, won the FA Trophy, got to the fifth tier, just didn't quite make it into the Football League, and then just went into free fall and disappeared. They've come, you know, they've sort of come back from the dead again, you know, again, a Phoenix club, same ground. But the sheer will and passion and desire for people around that club is far more evident in the community than Hull City, who are currently top of League One and look like they're going to go back up to the Championship. But the local community, the people that you speak to, it's all about the sort of the rise and return of North Ferriby, that it is about Hull City going back up and booking this trend of sort of free fall down into League Two, which was the fear, and going back up, you know, and that's sort of what's happening in this area. But, you know, for you, Stephen, is, you know, without wanting to sound, you know, mercenary about this, although, you know, we've chatted about the mercenary nature of football, certainly the top level, but do you think this is sort of an ideal time for non-league football, grassroots football, to sort of almost stake a bigger claim for the game again that's been swamped up and swallowed by the Premier League and by everything that comes with it?
Yes, hopefully. So I've got to at least hope so. You know, I don't live all that far away from Chorley FC now. I used to live in Burscoe as well at a time when they won the FA Trophy. You know, I've seen, you know, that level of devotion of those clubs, the people who run them, the people who watch them and invest in the season ticket. And, you know, you kind of feel like Charlton tipping up 2 or 3 times a season when your own team's not playing. But, you know, it's you know, wonderful to be there and be part of it. And you can see how, you know, attractive a proposition it is. And yes, hopefully, you know, the local team to people will, you know, prosper. You know, maybe hope that, like say, the story of spending £250 on going watching West Ham. You know, hopefully the £3 ticket, you know, down the road will be the more attractive option. I think the fact that everyone's world has suddenly become much smaller as well, you know, will maybe lean towards that. You know, I've had my season ticket renewal email come through last week. I've not renewed it yet. You know, I will. I'm sure I will. You know, as that deadline gets closer, you know, the sweats will kick in, and I'll renew it. Well, at the same time, you know, with about 5 or 6 weeks grace, you know, I'm in no rush to kind of like do it at the minute. So yes, you know, that people's love of football will always prevail. You know, people will always want to be, you know, going to games and watching games because it's something they've done. And once people start to go back, the bug will kick again. But it's just how they do it. You know, will they travel 80 miles to go and watch the team that they've watched, you know, on a regular basis? Will they want to go and travel the length and breadth of the country, spend thousands of pounds a year on following a team that's higher up the divisions? Or will they be happy watching the team that's just down the road, even going to the away games that will all be within a 30-mile radius? You know, it is a chance for football to reset and to recalibrate.
It is. And, you know, like you say, hopefully that is some of the things. I mean, I don't think I've watched a full game yet since the stadiums have been empty. I can't bear it. And like I say, I hope that it's, you know, that clubs will see or appreciate more, you know, what fans do actually bring to the game. But I'm interested, Mike, as well, that you talked about the book, you know, in your opening being almost part memoir. And obviously the book goes from your days as a ball boy at Watford. It goes right up to, you know, to visiting, you know, AFC Wimbledon's new ground. And it covers everything in between, like I say, in these 25 chapters. But I guess as you were, you know, like you say, as you were reflecting past, did you find that your relationship with football, because I guess it's, you know, it's ebbed and flowed as time goes, but did that ebb and flow mirror what was happening in this country at the time? You know, there's mentions of Margaret Thatcher, there's mentions of, you know, England managers, you know, the emergence of social media and the influence there. did you find that looking back, actually, your relationship with the game actually mirrored what was happening at the time?
Well, I suppose, you know, first principles, you know, the game has sustained me emotionally and professionally since I was a kid. And what I found, you know, being a ball boy was that, you know, that intimacy that we've been talking about, that, okay, I learned about, or I experienced the smells of football. You know, we used to, as ball boys, we changed in a laundry next to the home dressing room. So you can, you know, so there's a bit of soap in there. There's that stale sweat, you know, that sort of smell. But you can hear these muffled sounds from the dressing room next door. And, you know, these were, you know, guys who were on a four-pound win bonus, you know. And they all wore Puma Kings because the Puma guy obviously had given them all a job lot. You know, and they were the pros that you'd look at as heroes. But then occasionally, so for instance, you know, the last great Shankly team was broken up because they lost at Watford in 1970. That was when I was a ball boy. And, you know, you look around and, you know, you've got Ron Yates and, you know, people, they're like something from a Marvel comic, you know. They're just huge. They're huge figures. And Shankly, even then, absolutely fascinated me because for someone with such a huge personality and legend, he was almost unprepossessing in a way. And I met him before he died in 81. He was promoting a double album, vinyl album, which I've got still. And you know, I had one of those, you know, those cold sweat moments where I gave him a pen to sign the album, and the bloody pen ran out after two words. So my Bill Shankly autograph, the first two words are in black and the rest are in blue. So that was, but you know, there's a wonderful photograph in the book, of Bill Shankly in his living room at home, playing Subudio. It's just a brilliant photograph. And I wanted to put that in there because I wanted to remind people of his humanity, because the game basically let him down in the end. And I suppose that sort of disappointment has, you know, has recurred throughout my career in many ways, you know. A lot of the things of which I write in the book, they describe a world that no longer exists in many ways. You know, I obviously met Thatcher post Heysel, you know, instinctively loathed her, to be perfectly honest. And that whole attitude of pigeonholing football supporters as second class citizens, I found pretty objectionable, but it endures. That attitude endures. You know, watching football in the old Eastern Bloc, met Cluffy for the first time in East Berlin, had to introduce myself. Basically, I won't do the you know, the pub entertainer accent, but basically he said, you know, hey, big un, never, don't be a shithouse. He said, there are too many shithouses in your profession. So I thought, yes, okay, Mr. Clough, certainly. It was interesting that sport enabled me to get almost crawl under the political barbed wire, so that, for instance, you know, we were able to get into closed countries. You know, we got into Poland when there was martial law had been declared and Western journalists had been kicked out, simply because Poland were going to be kicked out of the European Under 21 Championships unless they played against England in the quarterfinals. We were allowed to go in as accredited football writers. Now, frankly, the game was an optional extra, so we got in, and there's always this sort of international brotherhood of journalists, and the local guys put a couple of us in to the solidarity activists, and I did the weirdest interview probably in my career, which was in a confessional at the Arch Cathedral in Warsaw, where the activist was on the other side of the grill where the priest usually, you know, here's confession. So, you know, that was weird. And, you know, I suppose, you know, my first major event was the Moscow Olympics, Brezhnev's Moscow, Soviet Union. And so I've seen the world change, and I've used sport, and sports enabled me to sort of almost chart that change. So, as I say, the one consistent factor is is just that humanity. And that I go right back to the start when I'm a ball boy on the line, you know, all those years ago, I could see the fear in someone's eyes when he was hurt. I could hear the, you know, the stud on a shin pad. I remember there was an old goalkeeper. I think he might have played for Liverpool, Steve. I can't remember, but called Bert Slater, Scottish goalkeeper.
Yep.
I watched his last ever game was against Liverpool, and Watford lost 2-1, and he basically threw both in. And I watched him walk off, and he had this 1,000-yard stare that he knew he was going to walk into the, you know, an almighty bollocking in the dressing room. And he never played professionally again after that game. So you learn to recognise those sort of...
Michael, let's come in there for a second. You mentioned Bert Slater there, right? 1983, I was on holiday in Fuencarola in southern Spain, and we came across this bar called Los Alimendaros, which is Spanish for the thistles. Because I haven't put two and two together here. I went to the bar, I ordered in Spanish, and the guy behind the bar says, it's Scottish accent. So you think I'm Spanish, do you, Meesey? I said, no. He said, well, where are you from? From Liverpool. I said, I used to play for Liverpool. I said, right, what position were you? So I was a goalkeeper. Now, one of my friends was a Liverpool fan, and he kind of says, Bert Slater, I remember you. He said, that's right, yeah. I was there at the start of the 60s before Jim Pennell took over. And we got chatting to him. He's a really, really sociable guy. The next day, I bought the local Spanish newspaper, and there's a report in there about Bert Slater turning out every Sunday morning for the local team of excellence in Malaga. So even then, he was still going strong.
That's brilliant. That's fantastic. I didn't know that. I didn't know he moved to Spain.
But, yeah.
So those guys, you know, when you're a kid, they become so big, don't they? In your mind, and you know, you can. I think that's, I say, the beauty of it, and that's what sustained me of it. But and also, you know, going back to meeting James Bentley with Barry, he's basically, you know, he said, look, the one thing that you know, it affected my life when I lost my football club. You know, I couldn't watch Football Focus. I never had a bet. I just couldn't watch any football. Couldn't even read about it. But he said he talked about. What he missed most was the contact with players. So he said, you know, I used to run on as a kid and slap people on the back, knowing that within half an hour I'd see them in the social club, and I'd be able to talk to the guys who were playing for my team on that particular day. That's what we've missed, because footballers now, as we all know, are essentially commodities and, you know, chief executives of their own multinational corporations. We've lost a bit of that, but the thing is. The one thing I was determined not to do in this book is to come across as some sort of carping old dinosaur, you know, that actually each era produces its own heroes, it has its own assets, and it speaks to people in different ways. And I suppose, you know, when I'm looking at the new era, I think the birth of Phoenix clubs and the sort of contact that we've talked about, I think will be quite significant, because they are, you know, I always love going to Barcelona and, you know, the Camp Nou, and I know I'm a sucker for the, you know, Mesque Young Club stuff, but, and I know it's pretty much marketing, but I like that idea. I like that the identity of that football club. And if a club has a distinct identity, whether it's, you know, steeped in tradition like a, you know, the Everton and Liverpool, or it's even, you know, creating its own tradition like Lewis or even Bury AFC, that where they're using the Lewis model of equality, and they're now, you know, developing their own women's team, which will be you know, equal pay. That's, you know, that's a modern model. You know, there's even more modern, you know, in the book and also in the documentary. I was absolutely blown away by this current generation of YouTubers. You know, okay, this is audio, so, but you can't see the grey hairs. You know, I'm doing my Silver Fox impression at the moment. But, you know, when we did hashtag United, and they've got a social media reach beyond almost any other club apart from about half a dozen in the Premier League. Then they said, oh, you should go and see these guys called the Sidemen. And I'd never heard of these kids. And there's seven of them, right? They do videos. And I'm, you know, I'm actually, you know, I'm probably demeaning them professionally, which I don't intend to do. But these seven guys, friends, they their videos, sorry, their YouTube collective following is 110 million people. Their videos over the last 4 or 5 years have generated 26 billion views. 26 billion. That is an audience that football manifestly hasn't, connected with at the moment. Leighton Orient, quite, you know, smart club, have linked in with these guys, the Sidemen. You know, their aim is to obviously get a younger demographic. They are internationally recognised, so that, you know, they're now having business deals with Denmark and the States and wherever. That, who's to say that, you know, an old fogey like me can't learn something from that? That could be that, you know, that could be a form of the future, that these guys are, they're using football for their own ends, but they are drawing a new type of fan into football. Who's to say that's wrong or right? You know,
it's a great point. It's exactly what I was going to come to. I've just written it down here, and that's the consumption of football. You know, post COVID. I know in the book you talk about sort of the multi-screen generation, and you know, I mean, the way kids have been taught for the last 12 months. You know, everything's been on a screen. You know, multifunctional, multi-channel, multi-platform. You know, multiple games all on the go at the same time. You know, and I was going to throw that out to you, Paul, you know, about the consumption of football. You know, is that now, you know, and as Michael's alluded to there with the Sidemen, you know, is that now going to change with how football's consumed? And you mentioned it earlier about, you know, you can watch, it's funny because I was doing my fantasy team earlier today, and I think there's 11 games, there's 11 days now of top flight football in a row that you can watch over the next 11 days. You know, the consumption of football is just, even from when I was a kid, it's so far removed from what I remember and recognize as a child. Are we now on a, like Michael said, the next step, the next stage, the next generation of how we consume the game?
Yeah, I think so, Stu. And you go back to what you and Michael were saying there before. It's been quite interesting, hasn't it, the kind of the shift in societal perceptions, because, say, 18 months ago, the big message was, kids are spending too much time on the screen. Kids are spending too much time on their computers. Kids are spending too much time on their mobile phone. Suddenly now, what was seen as a curse to society is suddenly the panacea that's opened up a whole world to people. So it just shows how a simple event can just change perceptions around the whole globe completely. Suddenly now, screen time is good, not screen time is bad. I think one of the things that kind of concerns me with the screen time is that it's, you've still got parts of society that doesn't have that access to screen time. So I work at school governance, one of my local schools, and they have families, you know, with five or six siblings sharing one mobile phone between, trying to access lessons. You might have the same situation in your college too. And so although it's great, there's this non-stop access to screen time, I think it's, without being outrageous here, it's almost non-stop middle-class access to screen time. If you can afford the Sky subscription, if you can afford the BT subscription, if you can afford the La Liga subscription, then you're almost entering a football paradise. If, however, you're someone on a very limited budget, you know, with a young family, you're on furlough, you haven't got that income coming in, A, you're under pressure from your family, from your kids to deliver, or B, you're almost, you know, having to make a conscious decision about what you prioritise. So I do have some concerns about how the sort of the different ways of consuming football might actually create a strata of society that no longer has access to the game by being able to afford the subscription. So I think that is a concern, and you know, it's I think a loser's to start. I miss Steve mentioned the importance of routines. You know, I mean, you mentioned the connection with your father, Steve. I mean, that would be such loss to football if that kind of the match day routine was lost, because, you know, I can't see your father wants to access the games on YouTube particularly. I don't mean that in a nasty way. He wants to be there. He wants the match day experience. So I think it's good. I think Adam Summerson mentioned on our conversation a while ago, he was concerned about the 3 o'clock blanket ban on screening football games. What impact that will have if that continues once the COVID restrictions are lifted as well. Because, you know, for some people, if you've got the choice of watching Barca against Real in your own home at 3 p.m, or you can go and see Marine against North Ferriby, you can see on a cold winter's day, people are going to go for the Real Barcelona option unless they're particularly strong-minded and want to support the local team. So I think it is going to change perceptions. And part of me as well also sadly sees that football seeing another way of getting more money out the average punter during lockdown, and the fact that Premier League tried to charge £14.95 for people to watch the matches this season was absolutely outrageous. And just like the European Super League, that idea is not going away. That's going to be coming back very, very soon.
It's a great point that Paul's made there, Stephen. Do you foresee, I guess, class division, class segregation based on who can and cannot afford to watch football as it is now being delivered and, you know, delivered to us? You know, like you say, BBC have the odd game. It's no disrespect to West Brom and Fulham fans if they're still listening, and I hope they are, but it's highly likely that it'll be West Brom versus Fulham that the BBC get. They're not getting the Manchester Derby or the, you know, that's not what they're getting. So, you know, are we seeing the potential or the emergence of a further class division? You know, it was ticket prices, season ticket prices. You know, is it now going to be the television prices, the, you know, the actual just access in general to even have the facility to watch the game, let alone to be able to afford it, even if you do have laptop or mobiles or whatever it is?
Yes, but that's nothing new. You know, that's been the case since 1992, ever since the inception of the Premier League. You know, I remember as a kid, you know, born in the 70s, you know, child of the 80s, and, you know, we did have a live first division game on at least once a fortnight, you know, through the BBC and ITV. So, yes, you know, football's being taken away for, you know, those that can least spur the cash to pay for it. You know, for a while, Channel 4 blessed us with Football Italia, you know, to make up the shortfall. What a wonderful way to make up the shortfall that was for a decade. But there isn't that now. You know, there is no comparable thing now. You know, when we spoke to Adam, you know, his points of view were that television will find itself very, very, very hard to reverse from the cul-de-sac it's now gone down, is that every Premier League game in one form or another is available, whether that's through Sky, BT, Amazon, the games that the BBC allowed to show. You know, will football want it to go back to a position where there's four or five games of a weekend that kick off at 3 o'clock on a Saturday that don't go out live on television in the UK? It's going to be difficult to reverse out of that now that it's being delivered via, you know, the most unusual times imaginable. Within that, you know, there is the possibility of striking a balance. I do like that the BBC have been able to show some live games. You know they have shown the odd Man City game here and there. Everton have been on a couple of times. Now, I'd like to hope the scope for the terrestrial TV contract to permit, even if it's just a small number of games per season. Next season, I think all the FA Cup games are on free to air because the BBC take up the BT arm of the contract. You know, I'm not against pay TV. Having football, I just think there needs to be, you know, some free-to-air access as well. I think the balance needs to be right. Yes, there is an overkill, but as Paul was saying before, I think they watch far more considered than they ever did. Now, I can remember a time when you would watch every single game that was live on the television, but there was a sense of occasion to every single game that was live on the television. Once upon a time, you know, that stopped with blanket football. You know, I'm sure we could probably watch 40 or 50 live games per week if we so had the time to do so and the inclination. You know, I'll watch one, I think, this weekend, you know, and then that'll be Monday night's game for Liverpool. I found it really difficult to watch football from empty stadiums. That's been a hard watch. You know, I can focus on my own team because you're that intent on the pitch and what's going on the pitch. I think a lot of football is just so sensory. And it's, you know, we all know about going to football grounds and how it feels. Mike's just, you know, spoken about, you know, that sense of being so close to the ground and hearing the studs clatter and all of that. And the very noises take you there, you know, the smells, the sounds, the temperature, the fact that, you know, on a cold day, how the vapours rise and everything will set. It's like music can take you somewhere. You know, the sounds of football can take you to a place, can take you to people, you know, games you've shared with friends and family. And, you know, television can't give you that. So, yes, you know, football has this difficult job to strike a fine balance. you know, the in-depth way that it's covered by both BT and Sky can be a wonderful thing. You know, it's there for the, you know, the people who really want to sink into it and watch it, you know. But yeah, it needs to be there to for kids to be able to see. You know, football shouldn't be something that's out of reach. If you can't afford to go to a stadium, then, you know, there should be something that they can watch on the television. You know, football should be for all.
Like that manifesto, I can run with that manifesto. I would keep you here all night, right, chatting for as long as I could keep you. And I haven't even got on to the fact about what it must have been like around the Hagler, Hearns and Leonard era, which popped into your book, and I was like, I need to not get drawn into that. But at some point, if ever we get to chat again, that would be my starting point. Also a child of the 80s. Just before, last sort of questions, I guess, you know, we mentioned Marcus Rashford at the beginning, and obviously, you know, you've been, as you've alluded to, you know, you've sort of sat with the great and the good that the game has to offer, be it players, managers, that sort of thing. And, you know, and you'll have seen a lot of the work that players do, that managers do in relation to the community that probably we, you know, we never get to see or never hear of, or is misreported by others, that sort of thing. You know, we've just sort of discussed the merits and pitfalls of social media and, you know, multi-platform presentation of information. But do you think now that actually players will now have more relevance to society? You know, Marcus Rashford, you know, seems to have had such a big impact, you know, in these last 12 months. Like I said to the guys, they'll know. If my mum mentions a footballer's name, clearly she hates football. So clearly he's touched, he's reached as far as he can possibly reach on this planet. If he's managed to come into my mum's conscience, then he must be either doing something horrifically wrong or fantastically right. Do you think this is now an opportunity for football and, more importantly, footballers to become a lot more relevant?
I do think it's certain some of the younger players are almost community beacons. You know, I think of Trent Alexander-Arnold at Liverpool, you know, which probably explains the emotional intensity of the debate around him and England. You know, there is manifestly a local boy made good. You could probably say the same thing of Phil Foden, Stockport, Manchester City. You know, those guys have got, obviously, they are still wired into their communities. I did say earlier on, obviously, that a lot of them commercially and are you know, pretty much they're put on this sort of commercial pedestal. But yeah, I think some younger players, you know, when you think about, you know, most footballers are, you know, come from working class stock, even now, don't they? So one would hope that they use their platforms, you know, for the greater good. I'm not expecting them to be social workers or anything else, but just to be aware of just what a fan sometimes has to sacrifice to go and watch them. There's almost got to be a bit of a social contract with footballers, I feel, because, you know, we're seeing now that abuse on social media is a daily occurrence. After every big game, there is always an element of racial abuse. And you know, when we look at the way football and sport and life has changed in certainly the last 10 to 15 years, the arrival of social media, you know, you were right, Steve, I think 92, the arrival of the Premier League changed the landscape completely. But now the arrival of social media, and you've got these, you know, I call them hysterical high priests of social media. There's a lot of ignorance and arrogance in that. And the vindictiveness is appalling. And it's so consistent, and football still is in an era of tokenism when it's dealing with big issues like racism, for instance. You know, we're talking when you know the 10-match ban for Andre Kudela been announced by UEFA, the minimum ban that they could have imposed after he was you know, found guilty of racist behaviour, to quote the statement. You know, there are UEFA members or UEFA committee members, even as we're speaking, bleating about the criticism that they've received for that. You know, we're way beyond token gestures. You know, I look at it now, if footballers want to use their power, and I do think they have power, I think fans have latent power. They have latent economic power that they've never really used. they've almost been cowed into that sort of, well, you know, show us your loyalty, you know, the whole tribal thing. And the tribalism of social media has got completely out of control as well. But going back to racism, I'd like to see, you know, it might even be, you know, the last game of the Premier League season, the entire Premier League walking off after the kickoff. Do something like that. You know, there has to be more than gestures and campaigns and neat little slogans and flags and armbands. You know, this is, you know, we're dealing with a real social evil here, I think. And football, if it can get away with it, or the football authorities, if they can get away with it, will look the other way. And we got, you know, the players have got the ability to make them concentrate on what's going on the pitch, or perhaps more to the point, what won't go on the pitch if they don't want to play. Certainly if I was a footballer, I'd be definitely out there saying we've got to do something, and we can't mess around anymore.
It's a great point. You know, I fully agree. It's not something you know, when I say it's something you want to see, that sounds horrific. That's not it. But you're right that it's what you want to happen, because that's what I think needs to happen. You know, it has to be an absolute statement. Paul, do you see not I mean players having a bit more belief in their, you know, as Mike said, their ability to change the game, but do you think they are becoming maybe more aware that they are going to be the sort of the flag bearers for this? They're going to be the ones that almost lead the revolution, if you like, with regards to what's acceptable and what's not acceptable on pitch, and take it away from the men in blazers, the decision makers, the bureaucrats. You know, do you think they will, that they are event, you know, they are now starting to see that the power does lie with them?
Yeah, I think so. And if you look at kind of historical precedents, I mean, Michael touched upon there about the power of footballers. You only have to go back to, you know, Jimmy Hill, 1960, 1961, when the Professional Players Association threatened to go on strike unless the maximum wage restrictions were lifted. And it got, I think, to within about 48 hours of them not playing football until the football authorities completely backtracked and agreed to abolishing the minimum wage deal. So, I mean, football has shown in the past has got the power to implement change. So, you know, if that could take place in 1960, 61, there's no reason why that can't take place these days now. And I do kind of wonder as well, Stu, whether you agree or not, I don't know. Are we getting close to the age now where we're going to see the footballer politician? So like you've got Imran Khan in charge of Pakistan, famous sporting figure who's now leading this country. How far away are we in this country from someone like Marcus Rashford, who's the obvious example, leading a political party in his early 40s and actually going on to lead a government? Because, you know, there's examples in North America of leading sportsmen getting involved in politics and having a voice on a national stage. So one thing I would love to see is some of the current generation of footballers. You mentioned Trent Alexander-Arnold there as well. You know, young players who come from, you know, really underprivileged background. I mean, Rashford grew up on the largest council station in Jordan, Withenshaw. And what an eloquent ambassador he is for his generation. So I really do hope in the future that you know, footballers utilise, I got to Michael's reference before, their brand, their enterprise almost, to be a force for change, to be a force for good. Because, you know, I mean, Boris Johnson said in the House of Commons, didn't he, Keir Starmer, that Marcus Rashford is hoping to better account for what you're doing as leader of the opposition. And that kind of gave him the case of the power that Rashford has generated. And also, it's probably helped to kindle, I mean, whether your students feel the same last year, whether Marcus Rashford has kindled an interest in politics amongst a generation who maybe didn't have that interest in politics before, and they suddenly see that some they admired set such store about these principles that they're thinking, oh, hang on, maybe I should be following what Rashford is saying as well. So it's a real unique opportunity here. And I agree with what Michael said before as well. I think football has let itself be almost tied in knots by social media. It's been happy to take the money without the responsibility. And I think at some stage, you cannot have a working relationship with a social media partnership that does nothing to stop racist abuse occurring on a daily basis on their platform. It's just not acceptable by any stretch of the imagination.
It's a great point, Paul. And, you know, absolutely. I mean, like I say, I now have students coming to me asking questions about whether it's Black Lives Matters, whether it's free school dinners. What Marcus Rashford's done is reach a demographic that Boris Johnson will never reach if he lived forever. You know, and I think that's the point, you know, like you said there, Paul, you know, about will there be this, you know, a political footballer, you know, you think of maybe George Weah, you know, in Liberia as well as an example. But it's strange because obviously, like, you know, we said there about Phil Foden and Trent Alexander-Arnold and where they grow up make them very relatable to young people, far more relatable than the privately educated people are in charge at the moment. And yet the world of the Premier League footballer is so unrelatable still. It's a really difficult situation. You know, who is the more relatable? You know, and hopefully, like you say, you know, it will be the player. But, you know, and I guess for you then, Stephen, you know, sort of a final question to you. You know, we talk about 92, you've mentioned 92 as a, you know, we've talked about it before in podcast just recently, about, you know, being a line in the sand. You know, do we think 2021 season is also going to be a line in the sand, but the off-field developments or whatever you want to call it with regards to the game, will we look back in time at this season and see it as a major shift in the direction that the game goes in?
Highly possible. It's highly possible. And that might have happened regardless of pandemics. Football tends to have a habit of every 30 years, maybe, throwing these forks in the road. You know, Paul mentioned the abolishment of the maximum wage there in 62. You're looking at the advent of the Premier League in 1992, and here we are 30 years on with talk of European Super Leagues, of all sorts of stuff, and you know change is coming. You know, and we're not like all of the changes, and within that, you know, this is where the power of the collective can make a difference. You know, together people can move a mountain. You know, I've seen stuff that Liverpool fans have done as a collective through the spirit of Shankly that's been absolutely stunning. You know, I walked out on 77 when we played Sunderland that day, and the snowball effect of that was the £30 limit on away tickets, which is still too much, but it was a step in the right direction. You know, recently the pay-per-view game against Newcastle and the movement to say, well, look, don't pay the pay-per-view fee, you know, donate the money to a food bank with the aim of kind of like coming up with about £10,000. And in the end, it pushed it and nearly hit six figures. I think it did hit six figures. And this is kind of like the things that a collective can do. You know, whether that's a collective of players making a stand, as Michael said about, you know, walking off the pitch together last day of the season saying, no, not going to do it, or whether that's a collection of supporters that will stand up against the excesses of football's owners. You know, it can socially make a difference. It really can. But yes, some, you know, change, large fundamental change is coming. Hopefully some of it is for the best. Because a lot of it will definitely be for the worst.
I feel like we need to finish on a positive. Michael, the book's brilliant. You know, thank you so much for your time, you know, for chatting to us. You know, the book is Whose Game Is It Anyway? Football, Life, Love and Loss. It's out on the 19th of April. But like you say, if somebody's looking to reconnect with the game, or even, you know, sort of younger readers, because I'm always, hopefully we get younger listeners, so hopefully younger readers, you know, if you want to look at, you know, football through a, you know, through a different lens and look at its development, look at its relationship and how we've arrived at the moment that we've arrived at, then this is the book to do it. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you. That's very, very kind of you. You know, I hope going forward that I think you were right, Steve. I think we are in another period of fundamental change. What gets me is that who's calling for this change? Who's supporting it? The fans that I've spoken to of the biggest clubs, they're not interested in it. They don't want 180 meaningless games just so football becomes a cash machine. They want what they were brought up with. Now, okay, there will be, it will evolve. I think what will happen is we'll have Premier League 1 and 2. I would tell the top six to go walk. Let them get in. Let them have their sterile, futile Super League. Because the other thing is, who's going to fund all this? It's all very well to talk about broadcast money. We're used to broadcasters underpinning football at the moment. But if you're BT and you're paying £1 billion for your Champions League contract, and your Sky, who basically underwriting the Premier League, but you know that your ideal demographic, i.e. the young demographic, don't want to watch live football. They want to watch 4 minutes max. Well, why are you paying all that money in the first place? Who's going to fund a European Super League where you have the so-called Swiss model, where you have long tranches of football matches that don't matter? The great thing about sport in general and football in particular is the sense of jeopardy. That feeling in your gut as you walk up the steps into your ground and think, oh, geez, I hope we win today. That's going to be lost in their great new, brave new world. And frankly, they're welcome to that. I think it's there is a chance here to actually recalibrate the game, and it could be back to the future. Let's have a reconstituted pyramid. Okay, you're going to have a Premier League 1, Premier League 2 of say 36 clubs. Why not have another 60 below that? Give the Bury AFCs of this world the chance to actually get in that pyramid. Now, am I an idealist? Yeah, sure I am. But sometimes romance is a nice thing sometimes, isn't it?
It's wow. Trust me, this is the place for football romantics. It's like Nighthawks. It's like that painting. You can always find us on a Thursday or a Sunday night lamenting about something in the game that's been and gone. This is definitely the place to go for football romantics. Don't worry about that. I guess then, Paul, your hopes and fears for the game.
Well, I think Michael's kind of uniquely summarised what most people have thought. Anyway, but yeah, I think, you mentioned there, Michael, about the sense of jeopardy, and I just cannot see a world where broadcasters want to pay for a product where nobody gets relegated at the end of the campaign. And having been through two last day relegation survivals in 93, 94, 97, 98, the feeling of fear and jeopardy as you enter that stage, and the feeling of utter joy and relief when you came out of both of those matches knowing you survived another season, it's utterly indescribable. And if the broadcasters, the proponents of Super League see a model, pan-European or pan-British or whatever, where there is no relegation and your safety is guaranteed by past performance rather than present performance, I can say, I hope that it's not just the older generation that switches off. I hope it's the younger generation as well. And I think you made a really good point there, Mac, that I think, each generation views football in a different way. So I view football in a different way to my father. My son views football in a different way to me. And I think that the generation coming through now are much more into, they're not going to be entertained by turgid, nil-nil battling for a point away from home. They want instant action. They want entertainment. They want to watch a team of Ronaldos and Messis. And whether the diets of football they're going to be offered in the future can supply that, I don't know. And in your book and in the film, you touched upon the developments hashtag United, and kind of begs the other question: is the future of football not based on the community? Is the future of football, is it an online presence rather than a real presence? I don't know.
I guess to finish then, Stephen, the questions everyone's now thinking is how are you going to renew your season ticket based on this entire conversation?
You know you are, Stephen. I'll
probably about 4 weeks. I'll play chicken until about 10 days before the cutoff.
We'll arrange a special podcast, but what we'll do is we'll have a Zoom call and we'll watch you apply live online.
That's got to be on YouTube, Stu. That's our Friday night YouTube. And we'd have a link with a betting company, at what time will Steve cave, how long would it go without fighting? We'd have a spread betting scenario here as well.
Guys, it's been brilliant. I think I'm in a comfortable place with the future of the game. But I agree. I think we are in a moment or at a time of great change and a shift. What that change and shift is, who knows? Some of it will be great, some not so great. And maybe if we're all still here in 30 years' time, we'll recap and we'll discuss the next big change that's come along. Yeah, and hope that you're still a season ticket holder, and that'll be that. Michael, thank you so much for your time. It's been brilliant.
Pleasure, guys. Really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Paul, as always, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Stuart. It's been absolutely brilliant listening to Michael. I've hung on to his every word, and I have to say, someone who could write a book and reveal to me that Barry Endine was once in Everson's books, it gets my utter admiration. I think I know a lot about Everson, but that absolutely stunned me, so that was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, I knew that.
Even I knew that, Paul.
I knew that.
You call yourself an Everton.
I know. I'm ashamed to admit it.
Stephen, enjoyed it?
Oh, it's been wonderful. Absolutely spectacular.
Brilliant. All that's left for me to say is thank you, and please join us again. Well, like I say, I can't promise. Well, it won't be an author of the same calibre. Just take who's coming, and that's no disrespect to whoever the next guest is. But yeah, please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.